Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And with the help of K2 Kilowatt Echo Yankee, Mel, that's his name, my name is Dick, the two of us run this thing called the Technical Net. The Technical Net is a gathering of the clan of ham radio operators and electronic enthusiasts. So I want to find out a little bit more about how all this stuff works, how to make it work better, a little bit of an explanation of how some of the other kinds of ham radio work. There are 26 different kinds of wireless enthusiasm, wireless products called ham radio. And FM 2-meter ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the kinds. Maybe you get tired with that one, try one of the other 25. And we discuss quite a few of those. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. And the word yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. I've been hearing tell that people are listening to this Technical Net by way of VoIP and I guess Echo Link and things like this. By way of the digital connecting modes, they're listening to this Technical Net in places like Dallas and Las Vegas and so on. At approximately 9 o'clock, 1 hour into the net, as long as things calm down a little bit as far as the immediate questioners are concerned, we'll be giving a nice long delay so that the people from the out-of-area, the longer-distance areas, get a chance to sign in and express their questions or comments. So, at this time, please give me your call letters and name if you want to sign into this particular TechNet, and the word yes, if it's a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
Into Z Echo Alpha, yes.
WW2W, yes.
W2RYY, Joe. Yes.
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions.
K2EJ, did you get my email? When did you mail it, Eric? In the last day or two?
Yeah, I think about 2 days, 3 days, a day, double R, about that. Something you want to read a lot.
Okay. Subject matter is, because maybe I didn't see it yet. Go ahead.
The history of the Apollo 11 camera.
Yes, I did, yes. Yes, I did get that. Very good stuff. Now I remember reading it. Okay, ZEA and WWS and RYY. Mr. ZEA, please tell me your first name.
First name's Glenn, and just a comment about a question I had a couple weeks ago. You guys were very helpful.
Okay. Mr. WWS, I think it's W2WWS, if I got the call letters correct. Please tell me your name, sir.
I think you're confusing. This is W2W, Tony. Is that who you heard, I guess?
Yes, it is, Tony. So it's WW2W. I bet lots of people make some of those mistakes. Alrighty. We've got Glenn, Tony, and Joe, and Eric. Anyone else to sign? And Steve. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Good evening, all. This is
good evening, Dick.
Okay, I heard Mel, who doubled with another person. Who was the other person?
K2JHR Mobile. Good evening. It's Joel here, and no questions. I'll be just listening to you this evening.
Okay, we got you, Joel, with an O. J-O-E-O, I guess that is. Alrighty, one last call. Anyone else to sign in with the TechNet who's got a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name.
Kilo Charlie 2, Uniform Lima Papa. Bill? Yes.
Okay, we got Bill. So right now, of the check-ins that gave us a yes were Glenn, Tony, Joe, and Bill. We'll start off with Glenn. N2ZEA, go right ahead with your question or comment, Glenn. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. A couple weeks ago, I had had to hook up a car audio system, and I was having troubles because the new set that I bought was going to go into a pre-existing amplifier, and after about a half-hour discussion, I ended up finding an audio guru, and we decided to use a low-level output for a pre-made factory jack, and the whole thing was beautiful. No distortion, no problem at all.
So it sounds like you're a happy camper. It was just a matter of finding the right combination of getting the right levels into the right port. And I guess you didn't have to add an attenuator or anything like that. Is that true, Glenn?
Now, once one of the guys said they need to use the low-level inputs instead of the output of the first amplifier, the whole thing made sense, and I was able to get to go on.
So I think you're saying that your source of signal had more than one output, and you had to choose the right one. Is that approximately it, Glenn?
That was exactly it, and it works like a charm now. Appreciate everybody's help on the net.
Okay. Good luck with your hi-fi system. Tony was next. I think it's Whiskey, Whiskey, 2 Whiskey. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Tony. My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick. My question was regarding the blue diode. Why was that? Why do we have to wait much longer for that to come along? I think it has something to do with the emitting from the energy gap or something. So was there difficulty in creating that? And also, was that integral, developing the blue diode, was that integral in creating the so-called white diode? That's my question. Back to you, Dick.
When you said diode, I'm presuming now from what you've said it means light emitting diode. There's zillions of kinds of diodes. Germanium, silicon, Schottky, and so on. Just tunnel and light emitting diodes also organic light-emitting diodes and the new high-efficiency types. In the very beginning, I think the light-emitting diodes, the first ones that became available were red. White is really not white, as you probably know. It's a combination of red, green, and blue. It's the only way you can really get white with an additive color system. And so I guess to get the right combination that can give you the red, green, and blue with the right ratios and the right wavelengths required some further development. Two of the people who are quite familiar with light-emitting diodes, who quite often sign into this net, are Glenn, KC2QIQ, and Eric, KE2EJ. If either one of those guys are here, I bet you they can give you a much better explanation as to why blue was so late in arriving on the commercial scene. Anybody with light-emitting diode information, give me your call letters right now, K2LIW. Looks like either Glenn or Eric are not available at this time. And what I think we'll do, Tony, is to repose the question a little bit later. More people sign in as the net gets rolling, and we'll find out a little bit more about blue. I wonder if you've heard about these, I think they're called AMOLED, Active Matrix Organic light-emitting diodes. It's kind of a touch screen, very bright screen, that's slowly becoming popular. It's going to take over for the ordinary LED type screen or TFT type screen. We're going to be seeing AMOLEDs on our television screens pretty soon, is one prediction that I've read fairly recently. When it comes to flat screen displays, and the kinds that are either front lit, back lit, or both, lots of development is taking place, and they're continuously improving in performance, angle of observation, and so on. So, did I make the right guess as to what you were talking about as to light-emitting diodes, and you talked about blue diodes? Back to you, Tony, K2RIW.
Yes, you did, Dick. You could safely assume, since I was speaking about light and diodes, I obviously meant LEDs. Before asking the question, I was searching for the answer on the internet, but the answer on the internet is you get a hodgepodge of information here and there. And I did see a last mention here of OLEDs, organic. So I didn't know if they were better. Anytime you see the word organic, you figure something wouldn't last that long because it wears out. It's almost like like those glow-in-the-dark tubes you break, that they glow for a while and they go away, you know, like a chemical thing. Something like that would wear out. So maybe they don't. Maybe they got to work around on that. So, like I said, there's always a lot of up-and-coming things on this type of technology, which is public-driven. They have an insatiable hunger for this type of stuff. Better this and better that, so you can't complain. It pushes us towards making better things. Back to the net control, WDFW.
That's K2KEY. I'll take a stab at it.
Please do, Mel. Go right ahead.
Okay, basically, light emitting diodes originally, you know, the original experiments, of course, are still based on the same principle of gallium arsenide, G small a capital A small s. Gallium arsenide, I believe it's the pronunciation of it. Basically, that type of chemical or that type of mixture, it basically will produce light, I believe, in the infrared region. So that is why I believe that the first drop-off that they used to call it, I believe that's how they refer to it. I'm taking this off the top of my head from what I've read over the years about it. Basically, red seems to be its natural first color that comes from it. But when they dope it, I believe the process is called doping. When they dope it with oxygen or green, a green light is produced. I believe that's the process called doping. If it's doped with, I forgot what else, another chemical, nitrogen, it will then produce another color, orange light. Let me remember now. So the mixture, I believe, from gallium arsenide, there is another mixture that is made with, they call the G-small-A-P mixture. That's called the doping process of this other mixture. And this is basically how it forms the different illuminations. I think, let me try to remember off the top of my head, you know, how basically they came up with the mixture for pure, you know, as close to pure regular light. I'm trying to remember what there was something else that was done, Dick, over.
I think you're getting very close, Mel. Most people pronounce it gallium arsenide. You've got to put the emphasis on the right syllable. Gallium arsenide, and the GAP is the gallium phosphide. The gallium phosphide transistors are the ones that have a much higher frequency of operation. Some of these super transistors that go above 100 gigahertz are gallium phosphide. And when you mix other materials in there, they call it doping. In other words, during the crystal growing process, while everything is hot, you pass another vapor of another material over the mixture, and it slowly migrates into the surface. They call that the doping process. I think that's roughly what goes on. Each of these semiconductor devices, there's all kinds of things you can mix in there to get the different kinds of responses. There's also something called a doping profile. In other words, how much of the other substance is at what level, how close to the actual junction, and so on. By the way, organic, I think, usually means carbon. If there's some carbon in there somewhere, almost everything that is organic contains oxygen, nitrogen, but carbon is the magic molecule that will latch onto a whole lot of other things. So almost everything we call organic, I think, contains carbon. And I guess that may be what makes some of the OLEDs, organic light-emitting diodes, get that name. And just because the carbon is there might not necessarily mean shortness of life. When it comes to so-called plasma display type television, some of the people complain about the fact that they seem to have a somewhat limited life, or they become a little bit more dim with time. The early versions, the later versions, are improving that. And we're going to see continuous developments in displays. When you're looking at the latest iPhone, GS or whatever it is, version of iPhone, you're looking at a touchscreen display, which is quite bright, quite high in resolution, and it's a touchscreen display that has all kinds of funny operations to it, and it really helps sell that product. Any further questions or comments on light-emitting diodes and the original question that repeater?
Time out.
The original question Tony asked is, why did it take so much longer to find a blue laser? How come blue came after white, so to speak? And I, for the same token, why was white so late? Anyone with any further questions, give us your, any further information they can give us, give us your call letters right now, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, another thing came to my mind, just K2KEY, what may be an answer to that question, over.
Go ahead, Mel.
The switching time of, you know, a diode actually is based on its switching speed. And I understand that because light-emitting diodes and so-called the spectra, the pure spectra, I believe, has a order of around 10 nanoseconds. And in order to get to the blue spectrum or to the more pure white spectrum, I believe that the switching rate is a factor, Dick, if I'm not mistaken, over.
Yeah, that does something to make sense. And where you said nanoseconds, maybe you mean picoseconds or femtoseconds. See, when I take the frequency of light, ordinary, the middle of the spectrum, say, for instance, green, which I think is around 550 nanometers of wavelength. And when you calculate that by dividing into the speed of light, that wavelength, you end up with the frequency. And it's something like 5 times 10 to the 14. Great big number. And so light frequencies are very high. Blue, the blue end of the spectrum is a much higher frequency than the red end of the spectrum, almost a 2-to-1 difference. And so when it comes to transit time and speed of the laser-like operation, I think that's another contributing factor as to why the blue came later. And for that matter, I imagine an ultraviolet laser would be even later than a blue one. But it's just a matter of time before we have those. In fact, I do own a ultraviolet flashlight, so, and I'm pretty sure it's a light-emitting diode type. So they have been invented. But getting pure white is a pretty difficult mixture of the right wavelength of red, green, and blue with the right ratio of their amplitudes. That's what the white consists of. Your eye has got the red, green, and blue sensing cones inside of it. And when you see what you call white, it really does contain those three components at just the right ratio for you to see white. And some of the Polaroid procedures that are used on Polaroid pictures didn't have all three colors. There's some other ways you can fool the eye into seeing colors that are not necessarily there. Your eye is a kind of a frequency discriminator, a little bit like, I'm trying to think now, it's Foster-Seeley, it's not ratio detector. There's another kind of frequency discriminator, which has got two separate coils, one tuned high and one tuned low. One has a positive rectifier, one has a negative rectifier. Put them together in the right combination, and you make the characteristic S-curve of a good frequency discriminator. And it's got a proper man's name, I can't think of it now, Land or something like that, is the kind of, Travis, there it is, the Travis discriminator, frequency discriminator, one of the really early versions, which probably came along before Foster-Seeley and ratio.
Repeater, timeout.
TRD Tiger. Say that again? Go ahead, Doug. You probably have more information as to why blue came so much later. That was Tony's original question. Why, when it comes to light-emitting diodes, do we have to wait so long for blue? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, it's the process of LEDs and making them tunnel, because what happens is the light emits from this tunneling effect between the two layers. It's the higher frequencies that have been more difficult to create. And of late, we have white LEDs, which are really not the kind of white that comes from the sun. So this is really a spectral addition of red, green, and blue. And they're very narrow bandwidth, each one. One's at 660, one's at 720. I think the one, I forget where blue is, it's up higher. And the efficiency of blue LEDs in the past 10 years has increased by a factor of about 10. That's why we're able to have these white LEDs. And you'll find that they come in various different sizes. We're now capable of making LEDs that will run at 5 and 10 watts. Create a tremendous amount of heat in the process, but they're terribly efficient. So even stage lighting today is is being done by white LEDs. As far as why it's been taking so long to get higher in frequency, it's because of electron lithography and the ability to do vapor deposition of the material that they need to for doping to create this tunneling effect. K2RW, KE2 is here. Oh, by the way, it's, what you're thinking of really is a ratio detector. A Polaroid, they don't use a primary. They don't exactly use secondaries either. Secondaries would be, as you would see in traditional film, would be cyan, magenta, and yellow, which are combinations of red and green and blue. So actually, when we think of red, green, and blue, it is an additive process, and generally, when you're doing print media, it's a subtractive process. So that's reflective, what we mean by subtractive, let me maybe drop for a second. What we mean by subtractive is if you have white light shining on a dye, what it does is erases everything except for the color that's being reflected. So if you have something that's red pigment on paper, it absorbs the green and the blue light and only reflects the red light. K2RWK2 again.
Now, for those who don't already know it, Eric works in television broadcast for the PBS network. I am kind of curious, Eric, of the very bright lights that used to be used in studios to do studio lighting for a particular scene. Like, I guess there's a lot of lighting going on in that room when you're doing a pledge drive. I'm guessing that in the past, those lights used to be incandescent. I don't think you used fluorescent because I think they're much more difficult to live with the spectrum that comes out of them. I wonder how many of the studios are you familiar with right now are starting to use light-emitting diodes for studio lighting. How back to you, Eric.
K2IW, K2J. Actually, if you go into David Letterman's studio, there is not a single incandescent lamp in that entire facility. They're all fluorescent. It's only the past 2 years that we've gotten into LED lighting. Fluorescents actually, for the past 10 years, have been very manageable. They're very cool. They don't throw off much heat. It takes a little bit more square area to create the amount of light that you would get with a halogen bulb, which is basically thoriated tungsten in either a noble gas or some of them are. Some of them have iodine and what else is in it? There's a slight mixture. But in many, many studios, you'll find quartz lighting, which is, it's a bulb filled with a halogen. And it's still pretty damn efficient for making a lot of light. If you look at a movie set, they're doing something called HMIs, which is really... similar to the sodium lamp, except that the mercury vapor. And they create a very high color temperature. HMIs create a color temperature around 64 to 6800 degrees. Traditional indoor stage lighting with halogen lamps around 3200 degrees. The fluorescents tend to be real close to 4000 degrees, which is why in studios they tend not to mix the fluorescents with the halogen, but people do. And of course the latitude of the cameras are capable of balancing anywhere from 2,000 degrees up to about 7,000 degrees in terms of light, and that's in Kelvin. K2RW, K2J.
Comment?
Comment, we're going to pick you up in a second. I got a couple of more questions here, Eric, and that is, when it comes to fluorescent lighting, the old-fashioned 40-watt, 48-inch long fluorescent tubes, I've got one of those in the main lighting in my bathroom, tends to be kind of bluish and harsh in the old days. If you're willing to spend two or three times the price, you can get what's called a full spectrum bulb. And I've been buying those over the last couple of years, and they look a lot prettier. And because they look so much prettier, I'm willing to pay two or three times the price. I do notice, though, that the full spectrum bulbs seem to have slightly less hours of operation. I also notice that at the end of life, they get a little bit dimmer, get not quite as good on full spectrum, and they also seem to be drawing a lot more current in that my lighting fixture makes a loud buzzing noise when the bulb is near the end of life. I wonder if you've got a guess, Eric, as to what's going on there with the full spectrum type fluorescent bulbs. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Do white LEDs give the same light as full spectrum bulbs?
Oh.
right. K2RWK2J. The full spectrum bulb, it's all about the plastic. The gas is the same inside. And you'll notice that those bulbs tend to go a little bit red as they get older. Don't forget, blue is a higher frequency, requires more energy, there's more photons bouncing around. Actually, the amount of current that they draw is a little bit higher because of the space charge that's created and the amount of energy that's required to excite them. So the actual internal resistance of the bulb is slightly lower. It has a higher density of mercury in it, which actually, if you were to get rid of the phosphor on the bulb, it would be emitting ultraviolet light, which is where the energy to excite the phosphors come from. Back to you.
Okay, good information. Thank you, Eric. A person who wanted to make a comment, who was that? Give me a call. What is the name, sir?
It's the question originator, WWW Anthony.
Sure.
Can I go to the question?
A white LEDs give the same full spectrum lighting as the fluorescent type bulb? Keep it to me right tonight.
Yeah, I think you're asking. Okay, now that we can hear you, please repeat that question.
I got the answer.
Go ahead, Eric.
Actually, you'll find that a white LED is not the same as a full spectrum bulb. A full spectrum bulb, if you put it over a spectrograph, you find out it's not really very full spectrum. It's more full spectrum than a white LED is. When you look at a white LED in a spectrograph, you'll find that it has three distinct lines, and they're very narrow. One being at 660, one being at 680 or 720, I forget, and one that's in the range of the blue. They don't produce a lot of energy off to either side of where they are actually oscillating. You can think of LEDs as oscillators, and they oscillate pretty much purely at one frequency. And when you take the three, red, green, and blue, and you mix them together, you get white. Okay, you get what appears to be, what really we're doing is we're fooling the eye into thinking that every frequency of light is there, but it's not.
Yeah, that's one of the points that I think should be made a little bit more clear. Real solar output, if you plotted it on the spectrum analyzer, is a sort of a Gaussian-shaped curve where red is at the low frequency end and blue and ultraviolet is at the high frequency end, and there's a sort of a Gaussian-shaped curve with a peak somewhere near 550 nanometers, which is near green, is where it peaks. So all the spectrum is there in real sunlight. And the eye thinks it sees white by way of its red and green and blue sensitive cones in the eye, which are near the fovea, the center section of the eye. The high resolution portion of the eye is color sensitive. The low intensity sensitivity, the rods, are off to one side primarily in the eye. That's the reason why a serious astronomer uses what's called averted vision. In other words, he doesn't look directly at a dim star. He looks off to one side so that he's using the rods of the eye, which are very sensitive to low-level light. That's the good news. They see low-level light. The bad news is the rods cannot determine color. Therefore, all cats are gray at nighttime, if you know what I mean. All stars look like they're just a little white dots. You use your time exposure on any kind of a modern-day camera and take a picture of the sky, and you'll rapidly realize that the stars are every single color in the rainbow, red, green, blue, whatever. Those stars really have those colors. Your eye is just not sensitive to those colors because it's not bright enough to light up your rods, your red, green, and blue cone. So we're fooling the eye with these full spectrum, so-called full spectrum devices. We give enough of the response to each of those color bands so that the eye thinks the spectrum is continuous. But the way you make an oscillator for red, green, and blue by way of light-emitting diode, it's a very narrow band oscillating device. It does not give you a full spectrum. There's various ways you can fool the eye, and it's good enough most of the time. I guarantee there are some people, though, who have different kinds of vision who can recognize the difference right away. In fact, let me ask you that one, Eric. From what you know about normal human perception of chrominance, I'll bet you there are people who can right away see the difference between artificial white and true white by way of the sun. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Let's put it this way. I'll give you two different kinds of examples in terms of people's perception. What we're talking about is perception, which really, part of it is a learned response. I mean, we're human beings, and when we see something that we call a cup, we look at something, we see its structure, we have learned that it's a cup, okay? But we don't actually know if you and I see the same exact thing. Our brains interpret it so that we agree that this is a learned response, that this object that we're looking at is a cup. Now, because of that concept, I mean, nobody can reach inside the other's brain and say, this is what we see. Right? You can take... I used to work in a post-production house where we did film transfers, and there's a device called a telecine, which turns the film into a piece of video. Now, you have clients come in who are doing a product, they're making a commercial. Let's say it's a can of Comet that has a certain green, right? You have people that come in, and it'll be the end of the day, and you spend a lot of time adjusting just the product so it just looks at the right color, and you take a snapshot of it in an electronic device. Right? Send somebody out of the room for a while, and bring them back in, and show them two pictures, and ask them to tell you which was the one that was the exact green that they saw before. And you will find that people will remember, and for the most part, they think they absolutely have it right. And when you put the snapshot up and put it against it, it's not the same. Rarely, and I mean rarely, will someone come in and remember that color so ever so precisely. It's really a rare characteristic of a human being. So that kind of perception is a little bit tough to start with. But if you were to take a look at the sun through a spectrograph, you know, send it through a prism and count the lines and look at the lines, you know that the lines of emission are going to be centered around where hydrogen is and where helium is. And you'll find that there's gaps in between. So that natural spectrum of light that comes from our star or our sun has a particular set of characteristics. And those characteristics are...
Repeater, time out.
Yeah, during that dropout, Eric was telling us that when a cinematographer says, hurry up, we're going to lose the light, it doesn't mean that it's getting too dark. It means that the color temperature that you see from the sun is very different at high noon than it is at dawn or at dusk. And so to get the right color of the sun so that the resultant film comes out right is one of the things they're worried about. It turns out that the human eye and visual system has what I think is a kind of automatic gain control system that works independently on the red, green, and blue sensitive cones of your eye. The reason I'm guessing that it does that is because on a couple of occasions I've walked into a particular greenhouse, the Staples greenhouse in Deer Park, where they got green glass, and the first time you walk into that greenhouse to buy your fertilizer or chemistry or whatever, the place looks extremely green. You dwell there for 10 minutes, and all of a sudden your eyes readjust, and everything looks normal. And all the colors look normal because your eyes have readjusted the color ratios that are coming through that green glass. As you walk out of that greenhouse and you walk outdoors, all of a sudden everything looks pinkish and red until your eyes readjust. So part of what Eric is telling us is that when he was at this place that was producing these media, he ran into the problem of people walking outside, coming back in, seeing different colors and complaining to him that it wasn't right, and they couldn't possibly believe that it was their own human perception that was changing. Is that roughly what was going on there, Eric? Go ahead.
Very much true, but there's also the concept of memory and how you take the input from your eyes, put them in your memory, and recall it to the extent that you can imperceptibly detect a change in what you're looking at. I mean, assume that you walked out of that room and went into a pitch black room where you would have no influence of a different color temperature light and came back in. The process of memory itself and recognition is so variable, and it's really tough. I mean, there are people that can remember the serial number of a dollar bill and have instant recall over it. But those are few and far between the, those who might be able to remember two, three, maybe four numbers out of the 12 digits that's there. So it's part of that same process. So, you know, you might want to say that the external influence throws you off, which it does, actually. But just the basic concept of human physiology gets in the way.
Comment from who? Yeah, I said I had a comment before. We didn't get picked up. It's the originator, Tony, WF2W. Could I just quick comment?
Go right ahead, Tony. I know we've gone a little bit off of your original subject, but it's such a fascinating subject. We're having some fun with it. You got it, Tony.
Yeah, it is connected to things because, you know, frequencies generated pickup residences, and I worked in two fields in my life, and one hobby having to do with photography. I used to print color prints myself, so I was familiar with that. I used to use physical packs of, you know, yellow, magenta, and you wouldn't need the cyan because it would have a tripod effect, whatever. And it was also, that was manually done for color printing. Also, there was a dial-in dichroic system, which is more money. I didn't get there once, so I was doing it manually. Now, you would think that it would be great if you could have the dial-in stuff with the LEDs, but like the other gentleman said, you're just having a spike type of generation of white light. It's not really a, like I said, the Gaussian, nice Gaussian dull curve as generated from what's actually a star is a noise generator. And that's what you're really looking at when you're looking at white light spread out. The other field I worked in was a dental lab field. And dealing with porcelain, it's even more nightmarish than printing because it's something that people deal with every day. If you go to a club where they have and that party type of ultraviolet lighting, you look at people's mouths and you can immediately see which are fake teeth, which are normal, because of even using white light, if there's a UV component, some dyes would tend to fluoresce and add to something to give it a strange color. So it's very, very difficult to mimic nature using porcelains and you know, other non-organic inorganic materials. So. So blue, they're very good to use to evaluate, you know, systems. And like I say, I also own I picked up a low UV and a high UV, and you can't even see the one when it's lit. I have to put it next to a piece of fluorescent paper or something to see that it's lit. And I also bought a little thing from Radio Shack to see if my, let me drop it a second. Yeah, to test if my, if you have a, what do you call it, a TV remote thing, maybe it's working in another system so you can't test it, whatever you have, components you have there. You just want to see if it's dead or alive. A little card that you put up with a little dye on it in front of your thing, when you press the button, it lights up. So this fluorescent also works on the other end of the spectrum. I forget the name of it. You know, have to deal with infrared, and you can even see if something is working with that. So all these dyes and they're affected differently by these various frequencies, and they create light in another portion of the spectrum because of the excitation. Back to you, and thanks for answering the question why this took so long, because technology had to become much more refined in the tunneling effect and everything. So that, I guess it took a while to tweak that, and they're up into the ultraviolet at this point. Back to net, WWW.
Very fine, Tony. Great you asked the question. It's fascinating. Human perception of light and color, chromaticity, there are people who have spent a lifetime on that. And you can study the various forms of so-called disease where people have color ignorance or color blindness, partial color blindness. There are some people who can't tell the difference between brown and red because those particular pigments in the eye are not active. Fun type stuff. There's a comment I was going to make, but it looks like the idea is just going out of my mind right now. We may come back to a couple more words on color when I think of it. For the time being, we're going to go over to Joe, the next person who asked us a question. To meet you all,
let me add some.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Just to complete the thought in terms of color perception, television that you see There's another element in this that we haven't considered. Since the eyeball has rods and cones, we have one part of our eye, for those who are colorblind, that still see black and white, or the various different gray scales of light. Okay, in color television, we have two components. We have the black and white component, and we have the color component, and they work together. You can have one color, like red, and you change the amount of black and white information that actually changes the intensity and the brightness. And actually, that can shift the way the eye perceives color. It can go from a red to an orange. So it's more than just an absolute a mixture of these lights. Same thing in film. If you look at the reciprocity curve of film, most films, actually, if you want to talk about slide film, which is a nice one, there's actually a yellow filter that's built into the film layer itself, and behind that is a black and white layer. And that actually causes the major density of the film, and then there's another layer that deals with the color difference of cyan and magenta. In television, since it's an additive process, we use red, green, and blue. If you look at the phosphors on your screen, you'll see that there's red dots, green dots, and blue dots, and when all three of them are equal, we see what our eyes perceive as white. But the other interesting thing is the sensitivity of the rods and cones, whereas that it needs a reference. If you look at your TV set with the room lights on, the TV off, it's not black. It's kind of grayish. And it's this contrast of having the rods and cones excited and not excited in your field of view is what creates that area of black on the TV screen that looks pitch black as opposed to gray. Anyway, just wanted to add that. K2RWK2Z.
There are a number of optical illusion devices you can use where two colors or shades are put side by side. And in the left-hand picture, you'll see one thing. The right-hand picture, you'll see something else, and they can really fool you. When it comes to that card that you can buy from Radio Shack that tells you whether or not your remote control is working, I believe it contains a kind of a phosphor, which you first hold into a bright light to charge it, then you bring it into a dark light, then you aim your remote control at it, and the infrared that hits it makes it convert the infrared to an optical frequency that your eye can see, and you'll see the card flash at you. Kind of a fascinating device. And there probably is a similar device somebody could build for ultraviolet. I think Tony also mentioned low and high ultraviolet, and I know what he means, but the words that are often used are near and far. Near ultraviolet is just a little bit above the bluish violet that you can see, and far ultraviolet is a much shorter wavelength yet. And the same thing when it comes to infrared. There really isn't high and low infrared. There's near and far. Near infrared is almost optical, and far infrared is way beyond optical, like 10 microns. And some amazing things that happen down there. If you're using a thermal imaging camera, which is something that I use every few days at my place of business, I'm using it for finding out what objects are getting warm in the field of view. And in my case, I'm looking at antennas that are being developed, and any portion of an antenna, some little component in one corner, an impedance matching device, or maybe the connecting printed circuit board, if it shows up as a blazing white object on a thermal imaging camera, which is really picking up far infrared energy, it tells me that the process of that object getting hot is dissipating valuable RF energy, and therefore we're losing efficiency and or gain, and by knowing where it's happening, by way of the thermal imaging camera, you know where to apply the corrective action. It saves you an awful lot of time on a couple of mysterious antennas that didn't behave the way we thought they should. That thermal imaging camera right away told us who is eating our lunch, so to speak. And with anybody with any further questions or comments on this subject, give me a call. It is right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KP2 QIW
mobile. KC2 QIW mobile. Start off your name, sir, and then your comment.
Yeah, Roger. Amiga, I'm on the path right now. Let's see. Okay. All right, I'm clear. First name here is Joe. This is KC2 Quebec Inc. Mobile. I have a question. I'll just wait for my turn. I have no comment at this point. Back to the net.
Very fine, though. QYW, Joe. I think you've signed in once before. Out of curiosity, Joe, are you going to be within communication range for a while as you drive? If, for instance, we don't get back to you for 20 minutes, are you still going to be within range of this repeater?
Yeah, roger, roger. I can't guarantee it, but you can give me a call, and let's see what happens. Let's see what happens.
Well, we'll try to get back to you as soon as we can. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, if you've got more than one question tonight, we'll take the first one. We'll go to Joe number two, and then we'll come back to you. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, one of our frequent sign-ins. K2RIW. You got it, Joe number one.
Now I just have one question tonight. Good evening, Dick. That question is related to a subject I think you mentioned to me the other day about measuring Intermod products on a, I guess, an combination of an antenna line and a transmission line. And I wonder if you'd elaborate and describe how the process of being able to do something like that when you've got high-level carriers and you want to look at something like, say, 130, 140, 150 dB down, DBC from those carriers.
Yeah, this is a fascinating subject. Eric gets into it a little bit, but people using cell phone development, cell phone base stations, get much deeper into what we're talking about here. If I wanted to measure the instantaneous linearity of an amplifier, particularly a single sideband amplifier, because any non-linearity there makes the audio sound strange, creates splatter, and does a bunch of undesirable things. So you'd like the amplifier to be thoroughly linear. One definition of an amplifier that's linear is if I go from 1 milliwatt to 2 milliwatts of drive, and if the amplifier goes from exactly 1 watt to 2 watts of output, at least over that particular amplitude range, that amplifier appears to be very linear. Now, when it comes to the degree of linearity that's required for high-fidelity single sideband or television reproduction, we're talking about deviation from linearity that's extremely small. The classic way of measuring linearity of an amplifier in the old days, somebody would spend a whole lot of time putting in half a milliwatt, 1 milliwatt, 1.5 milliwatt, 2 milliwatts, and so on, and drawing a graph. Well, that's kind of a sloppy process. It's a time-consuming process and gives you an answer that's an approximation. The quickest way to measure various amplitudes going in versus amplitudes coming out is a so-called two-tone test. You just plug in two individual signals on slightly different frequency during a two-tone test. And, of course, if you're careful enough to adjust the amplitude of the two signals to be identical and you're summing them in the proper manner using some kind of a isolating summing device, a good, well-isolated power divider used backwards as a power summer is one example of that. So you've got these two individual signals, and Mother Nature doesn't think quite the way we do. We think in instantaneous power most of the time. Mother Nature really adds voltages most of the time. She'll take the voltage of signal number one, the voltage of signal number two, add them together, and come out with a composite voltage during that instant of time. Therefore, when you've got two identical signals, part of the time, because they're on slightly different frequencies, they're exactly in phase with each other. When they drop, when they're exactly in phase, you get twice the voltage of any one signal. They're being added in a co-phase manner. And if the two signals are different by 1 kilohertz in frequency, for instance, then half a time period later, which would be half a millisecond later, the two signals are going to be out of phase with each other. They're fighting each other, and you get a perfect null. Well, two sine waves that are being added together on slightly different frequencies go up and down in amplitude in an extremely predictable manner, a deterministic manner. So because you've got an amplitude variation that goes from nearly absolute zero, that's when the two signals are out of phase, to twice the voltage of any one signal, and it's doing it in a very predictable manner, if the amplifier is thoroughly linear, it will produce an output that has that exact same waveform. The magic of that exotic waveform is that no matter how you look at it, in the frequency domain, the time domain, or anything in between, it will trace out a spectrum that has nothing but the two original signals and nothing else. The slightest amount of nonlinearity of the amplifier, And I'm talking about a hundredth or a thousandth of a decibel of deviation from linearity. Extremely small deviations in linearity that in a point-by-point manual test you would never have found, not even with laboratory instrumentation. A thousandth of a decibel of difference from linearity on the output of your particular amplifier with that classic waveform going in will produce a very predictable amount of third order, fifth order, seventh order harmonics, as they're called. In other words, your spectrum analyzer should show just the two tones coming out if the amplifier is ideal. Let me drop. And when the amplifier is non-ideal, you'll see other two tones, other tones. If my two tones are, for instance, 1 kilohertz apart, and my amplifier has a little bit of non-linearity, I'll see another set of tones, one to the right and one to the left, by an additional kilohertz. Therefore, there are a total of 4 kilohertz apart, and then a smaller set that are 6 kilohertz apart, and so on. Those other spectral components are telling you, if you're smart enough, they're telling you the exact degree of nonlinearity and the method of nonlinearity of your amplifier. Is it creating crossover distortion? Is it creating a phase distortion along the amplitude? Is it creating flat topping? There's a zillion ways your amplifier can make nonlinearity. And each of them has a characteristic display that gives a very specific signature on the output of a well-tuned spectrum analyzer. That's a little bit of the basics of linearity. Let me stand by a minute. Now, the most severe piece of hardware that I know of that has to meet extremely high linearity is a cell phone base station. The current specification for a cell phone base station is that when you put in a pair of tones that are each 20 watts in power, all undesired products coming out of the antenna system, if you're measuring the intermodulation distortion characteristics of the antenna system, and by the way, the antenna system contains no amplifiers, therefore it's a thoroughly passive test. There's no power supply in there, there's no amplifiers involved. However, improper connection of a connector not installed correctly on the piece of hardline, water in the hardline. There's a zillion ways that the passive devices, the antenna system, can create passive intermodulation distortion, PIM, and the people who work in the industry call it PIM. The specification for the PIM of the antenna system of a cell phone is a pair of either 10 watt or 20 watt, I forget which number it is, I'm going to call it 20 watt, a pair of 20 watt signals should create no intermods that are more than 150 decibels suppressed. What in the world is 150 decibels? That is a power ratio with 1 and 15 zeros after it. That's the ratio of the undesired products versus the desired products coming out of that antenna. An extremely severe test. And the instrumentation that can do that is very unusual instrumentation. Your ordinary spectrum analyzer, where you set up the controls just right, can display 80, maybe 90, and on a good day, if you're really careful with a really top-of-the-line catalog spectrum analyzer, maybe you can display on the screen directly signals that are 95 decibels suppressed in a two-tone test. And the specification is not 95, it's 150. It takes very special instrumentation to do that. There's only two companies in the United States that I know of are capable of producing instrumentation to do that. I was at one time involved in a project that had something to do with that, and I rapidly developed an appreciation of a repeater.
Time out.
I rapidly developed an appreciation for how difficult that test is. Every piece of flexible coaxial cable, for instance, that has a braided outer connector cannot meet that test by a long shot. It would fail the test by 20 or 30 dB, braided cable, because the individual strands of the braid are rubbing against each other, making an extremely slight scratching contact, which under normal amateur operation or normal two-way communication operation, you would never know it. But because there are so many simultaneous frequencies going on, both transmitting and receiving at the same time on those antennas of a cell site, they have to meet very stringent requirements. I didn't answer your question all the way, but at least I gave a little bit of an introduction. I wonder if this is close to the data you're looking for, Joe. WQRYY, KQRIW.
You did answer it pretty much, but I was looking for something more specific, like, I guess more to the meat and potatoes of it. Like, okay, you got two carriers that are running at 20 watts at plus 43 dBm. How are you going to take instrumentation and be able to look at that signal with a differential of 150 decibels down from that power level? That's more or less what I was getting at. More of the specifics of how you do that.
Okay, when you're running a test like that, you have to make sure that your instrumentation is not generating the signals you're trying to measure on the devices on the test. If you're testing an antenna system and you're looking at either throughput power or reflected power from the input connector of the antenna system, you have to make sure that the undesired intermods created by your instrumentation are suppressed by at least 6 dB more, probably 156 dB down. That's the first requirement, to make sure you're not making the intermods you're trying to measure. Second of all, once your instrumentation is clean enough, how do you actually measure it? It requires individual amplifiers that are generating the 20 watts, which have extreme linearity, extremely well narrowband filtered, probably have very high power circulators where the circulators themselves are not making intermods. An ordinary circulator will not pass this test. So it takes a specific circulator, specific amplifier, specific filter, specific very carefully designed power summing device with duplexing filtering, which passes the frequencies of the intermods and rejects the individual tones but properly terminates them. You require filtering that's called constant impedance filtering. The majority of the filtering that we ordinarily lay our hands on is a so-called impedance rejecting filter, my word for it. In other words, every filter that you and I have ever designed under normal circumstances has a so-called passband and a whole bunch of stopband frequencies. The passband frequencies, the filter represents the 50 ohm input and output impedance in the ideal world, and the signal flows through with very little insertion loss. On the stopband frequencies, the filter is acting like either a short circuit or an open circuit. It's reflecting all the rejected energy. Well, there's a special class of filters which act like a 50 ohm load DC to light, even on the reject frequencies. And if you're using those kind of filters, you stand a chance. So a combination of exotic filtering, exotic amplifiers, circulators, summers, and whatever, you got to do everything right. There's a zillion ways you can do it wrong. You got to do everything right. The chain is no stronger than the weakest link, so to speak. Every one of your systems under test and measurement, including the spectrum analyzer, has to have the linearity of requirement, has to have meet that linearity requirement. The shield
repeater, timeout.
The shielding of your spectrum analyzer is part of the tough situation. When you're trying to measure a signal 150 dB down, and the case around your spectrum analyzer only has 100 dB of shielding, if there's a sneak path by which the signal, the undesired signal, can leak around your cabling going to your spectrum analyzer, leak through the case, and eventually end up on that screen, it can give you a phony response. So, I haven't told you exactly all that's required. I'm just giving you some of the ingredients as how difficult it is to do. Because of the degree of difficulty, to my knowledge, there are only two companies in North America capable of producing that kind of instrumentation. I think there is at least one company in Europe and there's two of them in North America that I know of. I don't think there is one in South America. I don't think there's one in Australia. There's a slim chance there's one in Southeast Asia. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
It sounds like I'm asking for the secret recipe to something, and you're just not going to come up with it. Okay. I know you sort of skirting around. Well, I don't really skirting around, but, you know, I was more interested in taking something like that and looking at it in a different aspect. If you wanted to measure, say, a transmitter not with, or an amplifier not with two tones, but a single tone, and just simply be able to determine the harmonic radiation out of it fairly accurately to go something like, you know, well below 100 decibels from the level of a carrier.
A one-tone second harmonic test is a hell of a lot easier, Joe. By the way, I'm not holding back information. Everything I've said is the truth. How you actually carried it out, do you use brand A amplifier and brand B circulator? I haven't told you those details, but I've told you the exact methods that are required to do it. When you have instrumentation capable of looking at intermods 150 dB down during a two-tone passive intermodulation test, and you put those two tones into an antenna, as I have done, and you stand in front of that antenna 20 feet away, and you jingle the change in your pocket, you will see the intermods jump up on the screen 20 or 30 decibels above threshold. And you look at that display and you say, wow, that is sensitive. Now, when I ran a piece of instrumentation like that once inside of a house, I was continuously failing the test, and I thought I had a bad antenna. It turns out that the metallic structures in the house, your BX cabling, your wiring for the 110 volts, your plumbing, there's all kinds of metal-to-metal contacting junctions in the house. The house is continuously being moved by the wind in ways that you don't know about. Temperature cycles, portions of the house are continuously increasing and decreasing in temperature. Things are slowly moving continuously in that house. You put an antenna in the house and you do that test, and you'll fail the test by 20 dB all the time. The antenna has got to be outdoors looking at cold sky in order to stand a chance to pass that test. You'd be amazed electronically what you can detect going on in the house that the hearing and eyes would never see. If you want to do remote sensing of what's going on in the house, I think a passive pin test would be a beautiful way to know, is somebody moving within that house? Is he moving the structure of the house as he moves within the house? I wonder if it gives you some ideas, Joe. So H-U-L-Y-Y, H-U-L-Y-W.